All right. Good morning, everyone. How's it going? I'm doing well. So how many of you guys, as we get started here, work in men's health? I know we've got several members of Men's Health Caucus here. If I show hands. All right. Fantastic. So we got about three quarters of the room who are committed so far in their daily work to tackling some of these men's health issues, which is great. And I'm so happy to see our lady friends here with us as well, because as we know, women make such a wonderful impact in helping improve the health of men and their families. So as I get started here, we're going to kind of go through three things today. First is a little update on men's health advocacy. The second piece is talking specifically about some of the issue areas and opportunities within the Affordable Care Act that passed last year in March of 2010. And then thirdly, looking at a new, exciting, and groundbreaking document that was just recently published and put out by the Men's Health Caucus of the American Public Health Association. And we'll talk a little bit about the impact of that agenda, as well as thank some of the folks that are here in the room today for their great work on helping to make that possible and put that together. So let's dive in here. I have no relationships or financial interests to disclose. And just to give you a quick update on where I'm coming from. So I'm the Vice President of Men's Health Network. We're a national nonprofit organization based here in Washington, D.C. And our mission is to really reach out to men and their families where they live, work, play, and pray, recognizing that when it comes to health and when it comes to men's health in particular, they're a little bit of a tough cookie to crack. We need to bring men's health to them in environments that they trust and ultimately that they're comfortable. So you'll see here a lot of our work is concentrated in the workplace, in the faith-based communities, in African-American, Hispanic, Latino churches, working a lot with the federally qualified community health centers, and then more recently here, developing a lot of great partnerships and relationships with NFL teams, NBA teams, the PGA Tour, and a lot of other outlets where you might think would be a natural area for us to reach men. We've been able and lucky enough to work with the Dallas Cowboys, the Seattle Seahawks, the Washington Redskins, the Tennessee Titans, Chicago Bulls, and a lot of other teams. And the numbers just keep continuing to grow. I don't know how many of you have seen all the great pink that's been out there so far this year for breast cancer awareness at a lot of these NFL games. Our march forward and our mission for next year is we've sat down with the NFL Players Association and the NFL itself so far and have been trying to have a similar push next year for blue to raise awareness of men's health. So hopefully for next year, you'll be seeing a little bit more blue on Sundays with the NFL in addition to the pink next year for breast cancer awareness. So let's talk a little bit about men's health advocacy. I want to share some of the things that we've been up to, and also for you all as advocates, for public health professionals, as well as folks that are committed to this field, how can we work together to make it a difference, make our voices heard, and continue to make an impact in the work that we do. So what we've seen be successful over the past year and 2 years, specifically as we've formed the Men's Health Caucus here within the American Public Health Association, is really the power of the multidisciplinary approach. It hasn't just been public health. It hasn't just been advocacy. It hasn't just been nonprofit. It's really been cutting across all of those. So providers, public health, advocates, patients, and others coming together to make a difference and raise their voices and make themselves heard. The other piece in the overall men's health push has been the power and the partnership from non-traditional partners. The veterans organizations, seniors organizations, unions, women's groups, and others that have united and been willing to stand with us to really make a difference in our work that we're doing in terms of men's health advocacy, outreach, education, and awareness, which has been great. And then also we've had a landmark document here just published over the past 4 months over in the European Union. They actually had commissioned a state of men's health report that took a look at all across the EU, the impact of poor men's health on society and on the economy. The document is quite large, and if you're interested in an electronic copy of it, I'd be happy to give you guys a link after the presentation today. But it really is a document that has a lot of pros and a lot of cons in it, because what happened was the European Commission, as they published it, actually decided to leave out some key strategic pieces of data, which we found very interesting. So there's some sexual and reproductive health data that was actually cut out of it. There was some prostate cancer data that was cut out of it. There was some information around HIV and AIDS, the impact on gay men and gay men's health. So a lot of these key issue areas that you would think we need this data in order to inform our policies was actually stripped out of the report because the European Commission was a little fearful of the impact it might have if society at large actually learned of what was in it and what they actually found. So we've actually united with some of our global and international partners to try and hold the European Commission accountable to get a lot of that data back so that we can hopefully be able to publish it. So what have we been up to in the community, and how does that translate into policy and advocacy? So you can see here, we've been working with NASCAR. You can see it on the left there. And then on the right, it's our this gentleman right here actually has suffered from depression as well as prostate cancer. And this is when we were most recently out with the Seattle Seahawks. And you can see on his right-hand side there, he's wearing a blue ribbon pin just like I am today to support overall men's health awareness. So at the game and also at NASCAR, we've been distributing about 20,000 blue ribbons before these games or these races have started to really raise awareness of men's health across the country, and it truly is starting to have an impact. I don't know how many of you have hosted or partnered with either Congress, your health department, or a local state legislature. Have any of you ever hosted a men's health screening in your state within the Department of Health or within the legislature? If that's something that you guys are interested in doing, we do that here with Congress each year. This year will actually be our 14th annual year doing that. And it's a great way for us to spread the word and at the same time provide a free service to members of Congress and their staff about the importance of these specific health issues. So if you have an interest in doing that, we've also started to go out into the states and do this in different legislatures across the country. It's a great way to give back to the community while at the same time doing some advocacy and policy informing as well. So another great way, so I talked a little bit about the NFL partnership. This past weekend, in honor of Veterans Day, we've also been giving back through the NFL. We worked with the Washington Redskins on hosting a Time Out for Veterans Health initiative. And we partnered with 13 veteran service organizations to get the word out to be able to reach military men, women, and families. And I'm pleased to report we had about 1,500 military men, women, and families come out and take advantage of this free comprehensive health screening and education event. And it was a great opportunity for the VA to get involved, again, to talk about benefits and services, and hopefully closing the loop on care, that as we screen people, we're not just providing the benefit, we're also connecting them with care if they already didn't have insurance or coverage or access previously. So one of my colleagues, Armin Brat, is actually going to be presenting this study here at the bottom, which we really think is a groundbreaking study that we actually have never seen before. So it's going to describe specifically the economic burden shouldered by public and private entities as a consequence of the health disparities between men and women. And just to give you a quick snapshot, this is actually going to be published in the American Journal of Men's Health, which is a SAGE publication, actually this month, coming up in November. So be on the lookout for this, because what it essentially highlights and shows is that poor and premature men's health is costing this nation, in terms of productivity alone, about $140 billion a year. And if you would total up the overall impact of maybe it's partners and spouses losing men earlier on in life, that impact later on in terms of federal paying programs like Medicaid, Social Security, and others totals up to about $180 billion. So if you look at kind of this overall snapshot of what does the premature death and disability of men impact our economy and our society, we're looking at about $500 billion a year that could be saved essentially if we were investing in some key proven strategies in men's health and doing more to raise awareness of these key issues so that men are seeking more prevention and early detection of disease. The other thing that we've seen make a difference in policy and advocacy is more men like yourselves that are here in the room today sharing your personal story. And that's something that we need to continue to do, is to break down a lot of these traditional and social barriers that have been holding men back from maybe seeking preventative health care or making an annual visit to their health care provider. That's what's been so beneficial about the partnership with the NFL, is having players stepping forward and saying, you know what, I lost my father to heart disease when he was 52. I lost my mom to breast cancer. I lost my brother to prostate cancer. And they're willing to come forward and share these personal stories of what they've gone through in their lives, and then also their personal battles themselves with health issues. Is we need to put a face on men's health. And the more that we can do that over these next couple years, the better. Also, I talked about the importance of women. One of the organizations who's really been at the forefront of this push has been an organization by the name of Women Against Prostate Cancer. So these are spouses, sisters, daughters, and others, women who have been impacted by prostate cancer in their lives, who are telling the story of what this has done to them, their lives, and their families. So the more that we can do to support organizations like Women Against Prostate Cancer to get the word out, let's please all band together and join up with this organization to continue to make a difference. So some of the other policy things we've been up to is, I'm pleased to report that this past year in June of 2011, 49 states celebrated Men's Health Month and Men's Health Week in their states. So we've got one state left. It's the state of North Dakota. So I think this year hopefully we'll be able to give enough pressure and push that North Dakota will break down and recognize Men's Health Month and Men's Health Week in their state. President Obama also stepped forward this past year in June and recognized Father's Day, which was fantastic. And then also in September, we were successful in working with him to get a presidential proclamation recognizing Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. We have yet to get him to issue a proclamation on Men's Health Week. So that's our one remaining effort. For the past 2 years, we've been hammering his administration in the office to please recognize Men's Health Week with a proclamation. To date, we've been unsuccessful in doing so. So I hope that another thing that would come out of this joint policy agenda we'll talk about today is that we can encourage the administration to do more to specifically recognize men's health as a specific social concern. Just again, on the fun side, from the blue perspective, I don't know how many of you guys have seen that the White House has been lighted pink in the past. We also put a request out to light the White House blue, and we've yet to date been unsuccessful in getting it blue, but we did hear they were going to light it orange for Halloween. So there's hope that if we can light it orange for Halloween, maybe we can do blue next year for men's health. So I remain eternally optimistic on that. The other piece is we've been publishing state of men's health reports in every state across the country, and our hope is that we can equip you all as public health professionals, as advocates, with key information about what the picture of men's health looks like in your state. So if you all have an interest in gaining access to some of these reports, please come up to me afterwards. We have them published on our website. We can easily download them and be able to use them in the internal, external advocacy that you're doing there in your state to improve men's health. And then also, just wanted to give a brief shout out to my friends here in the Men's Health Caucus. So last year was our essentially coming out party in Denver. We officially launched the Men's Health Caucus at the meeting last year in Denver. And it was formally established in February of 2010. And the opportunity here is to essentially foster a better understanding and define and meet the health and wellness needs of men and boys here within this association. It was interesting working with Dr. Benjamin and APHA's board, because it had been about 25 years since they established the new caucus. So in February of 2010, we were actually successfully able to work with them to actually redefine the process, the bylaws, and essentially the framework of how you go about setting up a new caucus like this. So we're the newest one in quite a long time, and we've gotten some really good feedback so far about the energy as well as the number of members that have joined so far to really fight the good fight. So if you have an interest in learning more or getting involved, check out menshealthcaucus.net or come up and chat with me afterwards. We'd love to work with you. The other piece is we've also been successful at creating a Men's Health Caucus in Congress. So we have, again, sticking on this football theme, we've got two former NFL football players that are the heads of the Congressional Men's Health Caucus. So we've got a Republican by the name of John Runyon. I don't know if many of you guys know him. He's a big boy, 6'6", 320-pounder. So when you think men's health and just the kind of macho man, right, who might not be willing to stand up and support something like this, he is one of the greatest advocates I think I've ever met for this cause. So he is joined by his quarterback and former quarterback, Representative Shuler, who used to be a former Redskin quarterback, the Democrat from North Carolina. So between Runyon and Shuler, we've got great champions up on Capitol Hill who are carrying the men's health message forward, as well as being staunch advocates for us anytime that there's a policy, legislative, or other opportunity within Congress where the needs of men and boys need to be recognized. And also, we work to establish a C4 organization. I don't know how many of you have the opportunity to work with C4 organizations. Men's Health Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. The benefit of having a 501c4 is it enables you to do a little bit more in terms of policy and advocacy. So the Blue Ribbon Advocacy Alliance, kind of sticking with that blue ribbon theme again, is going to be that organization where I think we're going to get to do a lot more policy and advocacy work moving forward. So this is going to be a vehicle as we're gathering patient stories, as we're hosting screenings in state legislatures, as we're doing work with the Congressional Men's Health Caucus. The Blue Ribbon Advocacy Alliance is going to be that key partner and one of the worker bees to help us achieve a lot of our policy and advocacy goals and priorities moving forward. So I wanted to just share a little bit too about what's going on out in kind of the universe of men's health and how we've come together. So specifically, if you look at the prostate cancer space, for years, and I know this is true amongst a lot of different cancers, a lot of organizations, we're all aiming towards the same goal of raising awareness, but maybe our agendas differ by 80%. So we were trying to find what is that 20% where our agendas actually do overlap. Let's find that common ground and be able to work together. So in April of 2009, we were successful in bringing together 8 of the largest prostate cancer organizations in this country to essentially lay down their swords at the table and say, yes, we may disagree on certain points, but what is it that we do agree upon and how can we work together to achieve it? And I'm happy to report that group has now expanded to 12 national organizations. We actually have a joint policy agenda, much like the one I'm going to share about here in a couple minutes. But it's been a great way for us to influence policy. And more importantly, when we have key issues, I don't know how many of you have seen the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force piece here recently about prostate cancer screening and the PSA test in particular, this group and this organization has been a great way for us to bring folks together and speak with one voice. rather than having 12 different organizations saying 12 different things. Let's come together and hammer out joint statements, press releases, and materials that can help us effectively message around the issue. So we host a series of smaller roundtable meetings at the AUA, at ASCO, and a couple of the other provider conferences. And then we've also worked successfully with our friends up in Congress to host the first prostate cancer hearing in over a decade this past year. So the Oversight and Government Reform Committee in Congress actually hosted a hearing on prostate cancer to talk about these key issues. So for us, it's another way to show that by being together, we're stronger than we are apart, and it's also another way for us to successfully initiate hearing opportunities like this. And I'm pleased to share that I think the Oversight and Government Reform Committee is not done in looking at these overall men's health issues. We've heard some rumblings from some of the key members up there that there actually might be interest in a hearing to specifically talk about the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force issue. So stay tuned for some more information about that. So let's dive into the Affordable Care Act and how this is impacting men's health, family health, and, in my opinion, gender health overall. So there was one piece, and I know that the next 10 slides or so, you guys will be like, man, Scott, you're killing me with the negative stuff. But what I'm going to do is hopefully just kind of hold up this one area of success here to say, out of everything in the Affordable Care Act, this is what we were able to achieve. So we were successful in getting an Office of Men's Health at the Indian Health Service. But as you all know, as policy and advocacy committed individuals, is that it all comes down to the language within the legislation. So the key within this legislation is it instructs the director of the Indian Health Service that they may create an Office of Men's Health rather than they shall create an Office of Men's Health. So the kicker here is we need to continue to put more pressure on IHS to actually formally set this office up, because the legislation has been, passed now for almost over a year and a half, and they've not yet taken that step to form the Office of Men's Health within the Indian Health Service. So we need to continue to push forward, because we've not yet been successful in actually having them formalize this office. So it's a great opportunity sitting here. You know, you look at the data in Indian country around men's health, it's absolutely atrocious. You've got Indian men in South Dakota living on average to be about 56 years of age, compared to some of their female counterparts in the state of New Jersey that are living to be about 89. So you've got almost a 35-year gap between Indian men and Asian women in New Jersey. So what are we doing that can help to reduce some of those disparities? I really think that the Office of Men's Health at the Indian Health Service can be one of those things that could stick a stake in the sand and say, we're not going to stand for this anymore, and at the same time, be a model for us as we continue to hopefully advocate for an Office of Men's Health within the larger Department of Health and Human Services as we move forward. And I share this because our Office of Women's Health friends have been some of our greatest friends and supporters across the federal government. And by me sharing this slide, it's by no means trying to compare what men and women get. This is clearly to show how successful our women's health advocates have been at achieving their goals and objectives, and how much we value their partnership. Wanda Jones, who used to be the director of the Office of Women's Health, has been one of the greatest and staunch advocates for men's health and for improving gender and family health that we've ever seen or ever had in government. So what essentially our friends in the Office of Women's Health were able to secure was putting all their offices in statute, which is a great thing, because then it takes an act of Congress to specifically eliminate those offices. So there's now offices of women's health that are in statute at AHRQ, at CDC, FDA, HRSA. They were successful in formally charging the office within HHS to create a coordinating committee on women's health and to specifically create a national women's health information center to facilitate the exchange of information. And our hope is that looking at this legislation, this could be a blueprint for us moving forward. They were clearly successful. They also required that the director of the Office of Research on Women's Health at NIH report specifically to the director, once again making women's health a further priority at the NIH through the Office of Research on Women's Health, and then also at SAMHSA, again elevating these offices to where they truly and rightly belong. So our hope is that as we continue to push forward, and as hopefully that Office of Men's Health at the Indian Health Service gets created, we can learn from our women's health friends here on how we can better do our work and how we can more successfully improve men's health by working through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and its sub-agencies. agencies. So let's dive in on some of the key points that are things that we gloss over in the media a lot and things that are a little bit in the weeds, but I wanted to share them as specific areas that are of concern and of interest for all of us as we're healthcare consumers in this country about what's actually in the Affordable Care Act. So for me, as I look at this as a men's health advocate, a couple of things that concern me about the Independent Payment Advisory Board are that there's no patient representation on this board. So my ask and my plea is, as a patient advocate, how are we going to ensure that the voices of patients are heard within this Independent Payment Advisory Board? The other key and the goal of this board is to essentially cut costs within Medicare. And one of the concerns is that this board is actually exempt from judicial and administrative review. So if you want to challenge the ruling or the decision of this board, you're going to be in a tough place because there's no way in the courts or through the administrative review process to actually challenge the results and the outcomes of this board. The other piece is that they are required to find savings in Medicare annually. And if they do not, it's actually up to the secretary and currently at her discretion to actually make some cuts within Medicare. So for us, I'm concerned for both men and women about the impact of this Independent Payment Advisory Board. And I bring it to you guys today just as a teaser to talk about some of the key issues I think we need to be keeping our eye on as we move forward. And specifically as the super committee's recommendations come out, we need to take a look at if they're changing the way the IPAB or other issues impact us as citizens and consumers of healthcare. The other one is comparative effectiveness research. I'm sure many of you were involved in this debate as it went forward. What I wanted to share today is that we still see in the media now the conversation between clinical versus cost comparative effectiveness research. So as we move forward, one of our concerns is let's make sure we're keeping it on the clinical comparative effectiveness research track. Let's not get off track and just purely talk about dollars and cents and cost. And as we move forward with this, there has been a significant amount of money invested to make CER a success. One of those pieces of success-making opportunity is PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. So this board was set up. It's going to be a 21-member board. Those members were specifically named in September of 2010. You can see here who was appointed by who, essentially. And then now they're in the process of setting up formal committees. So as these committees are set up, I'm here to share two things. Number one, we in public health need to make sure that we're getting on these committees. And then number two, we also need to make sure that our voices are being heard at these stakeholder meetings that are taking place. A lot of times these organizations have a little bit of a challenge of getting the word out to us as patient advocacy organizations, as public health professionals, because you know they're doing their work in their respective areas. But in terms of trying to make sure that we as public health, we as advocates actually participate in these meetings, you know, it's hard to get these announcements out to all of us. So if you take one message away from today, please check out PCORI.org for when these stakeholder meetings are happening, because they're happening in St. Louis, in New York, in D.C., in L.A., in Seattle. We need to make sure that we have representatives at these stakeholder meetings letting them know what's important to us, because we did hear that when you look at comparative effectiveness research overall, there was some gripe that prostate cancer might actually be the first kind of overall disease state that they take a look at. And my concern is if by that time we haven't defined the whole clinical versus cost debate of how we're going to do CER, I'm kind of concerned that prostate cancer might be the whipping boy of kind of the first one to go through the CER process. So what can we do to make sure that this clinical and cost debate stays focused on the clinical benefit and clinical cost of effectiveness research? So the other piece is the Prevention and Public Health Fund. Have any of you guys here in the room actually received dollars or resources from the Prevention and Public Health Fund? Anybody? So for me, I look at this as a huge area of opportunity for us, right? We've got 10 years, $15 billion commitment to wellness. You know, clearly for us, we're looking at how can we secure some resources from this fund to practice some of these proven prevention strategies that we've seen work. You know, maybe it's the model program with the NFL or the model program with the veterans community that we had worked with. One of the things that did concern us about the focus for it is that it seemed very focused on breast, colon cancer screenings. We were kind of wondering why prostate, testicular, and lung, other cancer screenings were kind of left out of the Prevention Public Health Fund focus. It was interesting because the House voted to repeal the fund in April of this year. I know this fund is kind of a piece of controversy out there in the media that's kind of just a slush fund for Congress and the President to fund specific initiatives, but I would argue that we have a huge opportunity here with this fund to fund a lot of things that we care about and that we're working on in public health, in men's health, and in women's health. So what can we do to band together to make sure that this fund is actually funding things that we care about? So I listed here where some of the dollars have come from and where they're going, and I apologize that it's so very small. I'd be happy to send all you guys a copy of this slide deck. But essentially, if you look in here, I can tell you straight out that there's not a penny being invested in men's health currently in this fund. When you look at the different areas here, certainly it's funding very, very key programs, grants, and different infrastructure projects. But what can we do to hold people accountable to funding prostate cancer, men's health, you know, breast, colorectal, and other screenings like it said it was going to do, rather than funding some of these other initiatives around workforce and research and surveillance that seem to kind of go down a little bit of a different track from its original goal of prevention, proven strategies, community programming, and awareness and education efforts. So I just bring that to you today to bring it back to the top of your mind and say, what can we do to gain resources from that fund? The other one is Senator Mikulski, who's been someone who has been a supporter of ours and our movement and push in the past. She stepped forward and did an amazing thing for women's preventive screenings. What she did in the Affordable Care Act was essentially say that we're going to cover all women's preventative health screenings at no cost. It's a wonderful benefit. Like when you look at this, it essentially takes everything that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has rated as an A or B and covers that at no cost, and then it goes beyond that, and essentially that anything that's included essentially in any health plan anywhere will be covered at no cost in terms of women's preventative screenings. This is just, to me, is the model of a wonderful benefit that we should all aspire to have as consumers of healthcare. So I guess I'll just ask it this way. How many of you think that there's a men's preventive screening package? Anybody? Anyone here truly believe that there is? Okay. Well, there isn't. So we went to Senator Mikulski after she had introduced the women's preventive screening package and said, Senator, is there anything that we can do to work hand in hand with you to essentially have a gender health preventive services package? And unfortunately, at that time, she was unable to support our effort. I'm holding out hope that at some point, maybe we'll have an advocate or a champion in Congress step forward and recognize the importance of this. So what we've done is Men's Health Network joined with that organization I mentioned, Women Against Prostate Cancer, and we joined with our friends at the Veterans Health Council to say, here are some of the key areas that we could see composing essentially a men's preventive services package. So I'll start with prostate cancer. It's kind of just an easy one. Our thought is, yes, there's controversy around the value of the PSA test, but at this point, it's the best we've got. We've got to use the best tool that we have and empower people with knowledge to make informed decisions with their healthcare providers. To me, that's kind of what we're talking about here. And if you don't want prostate cancer and the PSA test to be for all men, let's at least make sure that the high-risk men, those men that have been exposed to Agent Orange, those that are African-American, and those that have a family history, have access to this wonderful screening benefit because of their risk is essentially double that of the general population. HPV actually just took a step forward for boys and younger men this past week with the CDC's ACIP recommendation that 11 and 12-year-old boys are now vaccinated with Gardasil. So that's going to be interesting to see how that moves forward. I just had done three media interviews about it because certainly that drummed up a little bit of controversy as well. And it was interesting because a lot of the reporters were focusing back on Michelle Bachmann's comments about Governor Perry specifically in the state of Texas requiring that women have access to these HPV screening. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. For us, again, anything that can prevent cancer is a good thing. Anything that we can do to vaccinate or screen boys and young men to protect their partners and female counterparts, we think is a good thing. So we're interested and we'll be working with Congress as well as the CDC as this kind of rolls out and moves forward. We've also stepped forward and said that we also need to have chlamydia and gonorrhea screening for boys, young men, and men as well, because essentially we're screening half the population. So what can we do to make sure that boys and younger men are also being screened for this, that in hopes of ultimately protecting some of their partners and female counterparts as well? And then our thought too was kind of like the well woman visit that exists, would there be an opportunity for a well man visit at some point? So we're trying to just tease our the thoughts of our friends up at HHS and also in Congress to see maybe if they don't go for a men's preventive services package, would they consider going for maybe a well-man visit at some point? So that opportunity remains out there, and we're anxious to see what comes of it. So here, as I talked about the task force issue, so just a very brief update on what happened. So on October 7th, the task force came out and essentially downgraded prostate cancer from an I rating of essentially inconclusive evidence to support the benefit of the screening to now a D, which is essentially, forget about it. This is not something that we recommend. The fear for us is that the recommendation does apply to men across the U.S. population, and it's all men. And I'm actually scared to report that I was speaking at a male nurse conference 2 weeks ago, right as this recommendation was coming out, and one of the top three health plans in this country, one of their representatives was there who's responsible for their HMO Medicaid, and they had gotten direction already, I think it was 3 days after this had come out, saying remove the prostate cancer screening benefit from this top three health plan. So for us, to me, that's just the beginning of what's going to be a very slippery slope, because a lot of these health plans follow the task force recommendations. And I will tell you, it's not just prostate cancer, because the gentleman also made a point of saying that breast cancer was going to be removed from it as well. So I feel like this is a real opportunity for us as men's health and women's health advocates to hold our health plans accountable to make sure that these screening benefits that were touted as a part of the Affordable Care Act, we're talking about increasing access and increasing services and benefits, and we're seeing these things being removed a year and a half after the Affordable Care Act passed. So what do we need to do as advocates to make sure that these screenings, benefits, and services stay in place? The whole point of the Affordable Care Act was to increase access, not remove access to these screenings and benefits and services that folks so rightly need. And then I wanted to kind of switch gears and conclude with the APHA Men's Health Caucus's joint policy agenda and talk about this true journey that we went through as a caucus and as a policy committee to actually develop this document. And I wanted to start out and recognize an individual that's here in this room with us. Justin, can you stand up? Because I'd like to thank, this is our key author right here, Justin Tindall. He spent the summer with us working on this endeavor, and I wanted to thank you so much for your work on this. It's truly Justin's tireless energy, his support, his efforts to help make this possible. We wouldn't honestly have this national policy agenda without your work, Justin. So thank you for that. Very much appreciated. So in addition to Justin's hard labor on this, many of our policy committee friends and workers and laborers are in the room here with us today. Mike Rovito's here in the room, Jim Leone. We also have my colleague Teresa Morrow, who's up there staffing our booth, and many others that really took the opportunity to review, edit, suggest recommendations for this, as well as develop this overall document after Justin had put such tireless work into actually making this possible. So let's dive in a little bit around the agenda and kind of where we see it going from here. So why do we need a national policy agenda? I feel maybe because of what I've talked about earlier, I don't need to make the case for you guys. At the very top level, 30,000 foot view, essentially, when you look at this health crisis that we have in this country around men's health, so what are the key issues? So men are living about 5 years less than their female counterparts. One in two men and one in three women in their lifetime will be diagnosed with cancer. Men are leading in about 9 out of the top 10 causes of death. And when you look at kind of that whole premature death and disability of men issue and how it's impacting women and families, when you look at as men are entering retirement around the age of 65 to 69, about 15% of women are already going to be widows by the time that they reach that age group if they marry a man their same age. So again, we're having about 85 men to 100 women by the time that retirement age hits. So what can we do to improve the health of men so that it doesn't have this disproportionate impact on their partners, their spouses, and women and families across this country? So what is this agenda all about? So the official policy agenda you can see here is going to stand as a reflection of what the Men's Health Caucus and APHA interests and objectives are. It's going to provide a theoretical structure that's going to guide stronger and more effective men's health advocacy in this country. It's going to guide the efforts of a lot of existing state commissions on men's health. It's going to encourage the establishment of other offices of men's health, much like the Indian Health Service Office of Men's Health, which was recently authorized. Becoming a foundation for the future of men's health policies, acting as a resource and truly a guide for our friends up in Congress and the Congressional Men's Health Caucus, and then also contributing to the development of these offices of men's health moving forward. So what are the key focus areas within the document? It's policy development, it's research, education and outreach, professional training, and access to health services. And as we went through this effort, and as Justin was leading the data collection exercise around this, what he had essentially done was identified five goals, and underneath those five goals, three specific key objectives to reach under those respective goals. So I figured I'd just share the goals with you guys at a very top level. And my hope is I wanted to end the talk early today because I really wanted to have a conversation with you all in the room about how we can effectively utilize this agenda to really make a difference. And also I wanted to provide, I brought about 10 hard copies here, so if you guys would like a copy of it, I have a hard copy, and then we're also going to be making it available electronically, so any of you that would like it, we want to make sure that you have access to it. So what are the goals here? So goal number one, strengthen national and state public policies that aim to improve the health of men, boys, and their families. Goal two, advancing men's health-specific research. Goal three, develop greater health education outreach targeting men and their families. Goal four, ensuring the development of better trained and more gender competent U.S. public health workforce. And then goal five, promoting strategies that ensure greater delivery and access of health services to men, boys, and their families. So as I mentioned earlier, underneath each of these different goal areas, there's three specific objectives that the caucus and specifically the policy committee have identified that we can specifically work on together to try and tackle and achieve each of these specific five goals as we move forward. So essentially, what's our call to action? And to conclude here, you can see it's all about safe and healthy communities, again, impacting the health and well-being of men and boys, ultimately helping this country reach its health potential, while at the same time ensuring the success of this agenda's goals and priorities, and really leveraging the vision and the principles that are set forth in this policy agenda to really truly make a difference. So my thought is this, as I kind of wrap this up, is we've had the Affordable Care Act out being implemented for the past year and a half. We've had the establishment of the Congressional Men's Health Caucus. We've had the creation of the APHA Men's Health Caucus. We were successful within a year of the establishment of the APHA Men's Health Caucus of publishing for the first time ever a national policy agenda that actually outlines the specific goals and objectives of what we need to achieve in this men's health advocacy and policy movement. So though we weren't as successful as we thought we would have been in the Affordable Care Act overall, I would argue that all signs are kind of pointing towards the positive. Many of you have come and banded together through the caucus, through our organization, and through other movements across the country to really recognize men's health as a key issue that we need to focus on. And as we move forward, we now have vehicles like these caucuses. We have vehicles now like this national policy agenda where we actually have actionable, evidence-based tools and resources to help us make a difference in the health of men, boys, and their families across the nation. So anything and everything that we can do to work together, this national policy agenda to me is both a rallying cry to bring us together. It'll serve as really the blueprint of where we need to go, at least over the next 18 months. And our vision as a caucus is that this is our essentially roadmap for the next 15 months, and then we'll be updating it as we look ahead towards 2013 and 2014. So we look forward to working with you in that capacity, and thank you so much for your time and attention this morning. And if you'd like to get a copy, our booth is 1001. You got the website here, or you can come see me for a copy. So with that, I would love to have a conversation with you guys tomorrow. I know I feel like I probably just hit you with a fire hose worth of information around what's going on in policy and advocacy around male health and the joint policy agenda in particular. What questions or thoughts do you guys have? Yes, sir. Yes.
Do you, in general, agree or disagree with what they've said?
I think for me personally, I don't want to speak for the caucus because I'd love to hear what some of my other colleagues think, is that I would disagree with the D recommendation because essentially what the I did, though it was kind of a vague recommendation, it at least put the power in the hands of patients and providers to make an informed decision. To me, I can't ever see the PSA test, the way it's been described in the media is that essentially it's harming people. I don't see that screening as harming anyone. I see it as informing people with knowledge to make a decision. And from a cost perspective, I can't really argue that it's prohibitive to the fact that it's bankrupting the system for men to go and get a PSA test. So I think if anything, it's probably confusing a lot of the guys that we're trying to reach out there at this point. And the recommendation overall, if health plans are going to be removing the PSA test from one of those covered benefits and services, honestly, we're really scared about what that's going to mean for screening, access, and men's health overall moving forward. Has that been your perspective too?
That's my concern. The problem is, of course, prostate cancer is one of those things that you can either choose to leave it or not.
Right.
But people want the information, and if you
Zoe? Yeah, please.
So what's the rallying point about this prostate cancer screening? I work with uninsured men with prostate cancer in California.
Yes.
Okay, and we have 20% of our population coming with metastatic cancer that they haven't been screened. They're dying. And these are not 65 and older men. These are men under 65 because at 65, the majority of them get Medicare.
Right.
So this angers me to know, I mean, it's ridiculous. And I've had a doctor I've worked with recently talk to the ACS, who then, after having a conversation about cervical cancer, and they support cervical cancer, 4,000 women are dying, 25,000 men a year are dying of prostate cancer.
Yes.
How can we support one? And he came as well, not for mass community-based screening. Well, no one's for mass-based community screening.
Right.
We want informed decision-making with your physician to have a conversation. So what is the rallying point about this? I know everyone's kind of marshalling forces.
Yes.
I feel like we've got to, like, walk on Congress.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous. I never in my life thought I would be an advocate for men. But having worked with children and then having worked with women, it is men who need the help. And I'm part of Women Against Prostate Cancer, and I mean, I just, like, what are we doing? Was there going to be, like, one massive rally? What
awesome.
Can we do beyond, like, write letters, I've written letters, I've made phone calls, like, what's happening? Is there something, like, a big push or something?
There is, and I'm so happy that you asked that, because it's something I should have touched on as kind of the next step. So actually this Tuesday, there's going to be a briefing in Congress about this issue in particular. It's going to be in the Rayburn Building, and I want to say it's from 9 to 12, and actually I'll get you that information, but it's specifically going to talk about, we are planning a rally. We are going to be bringing people to Washington, D.C. to storm the Hill, as you mentioned, and to put some boots on the ground to share this key message. So number one, there is going to be a rally. There is going to be a briefing up on Capitol Hill this Tuesday. So it's great timing because all of us are here in D.C. for this meeting. And the second piece is when you talk about, what is that key message that we need to have, what we've seen resonate is kind of that making sure that the high-risk men have access to this. If it's not going to be broad community screens, we need to make sure that African-American men, those with family history and veterans, are covered. And that's what we've seen work. So I think the more that we can do in the media to write op-eds and letters to the editor talking specifically about that issue, I think it'll help. And then getting everyone and their grandmother to come for that rally because they need to see the show of force that we're not going to go quietly on this issue.
Right. Well, beyond the fact that last year at ATHA, one of the people who made these recommendations, you for this, Rebecca Cochran, came and told us in a talk, we handled this badly. We were incorrect in how we studied the prostate cancer. And I'm like, come on. Yeah. This is ridiculous.
Right.
Okay, I'd love to hear about it. Because I'm actually talking with the men's health caucus, but I have time to go. I will go to that meeting tomorrow.
Perfect. All right, great. Thank you. And I'll talk to you afterwards about where it is and when and all that good stuff.
Okay,
great. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, just anecdotally, I was talking to some drawers down in Orlando, and they're kind of there's a urologist that recommending that the PSA is a great test. I mean, there's a problem with it, but, it is a good first marker, but it is important to make it so
wonderful. Yes. Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, please.
A couple of weeks ago, I read just a snippet about a new study that came out from Sweden, and treats a new, I think it's a Gottberg study is what treats it, by the way. But there was a strong correlation between what your initial screening is when you're young and whether or not you develop the...
Yes.
How can that be brought forward?
I think that the one challenge is... getting that, documents and information like that can be a great benefit for us as we're doing things like rallies and other things as a package of leave behind information for folks. So I think the more that we can take studies like that and boil them down in layman's terms that our Congress members and staff can understand, that's what I think we need to be doing. So the more that we can collect impactful data, research, and studies like that show an evidence base of why this is critically important, that's what we need to be doing. So I would encourage all of you, as you have those things, email them our way, because we're putting together the package of key information and resources to be able to make the case of why we need this so bad. Have you guys seen an impact in your funding as well for a lot of the work that you're doing, working with men, whether it's prostate cancer, men's health in general? Has the Affordable Care Act presented any unique opportunities to do more?
Well, I don't need to do more, but we have our program is the Impact Program in California. It's prostate cancer treatment alone is one of the big, like, California Department of Health. So our budget has gone, so we're, what, 13 years old now? So our budget has gone from $50 million down to $2.3 million a year.
Oh.
And we're fighting to survive. It's a struggle every time. But, and we're not doing screening. We're doing treatment. We're treating guys who are diagnosed with prostate cancer. So we're not even in the screening. But it tends to get caught up. It doesn't get separated. And, you know, we're only here by the grace of our advocates because we can't advocate. But
right.
We stay funded. But, you know, they've saved us time and time again. But it is the continuing argument. It's an old man's disease. You're going to die of something else. These are not old men. I mean, we've had 35-year-olds come in with metastatic cancer.
Yeah.
Family history, African American, had no clue. So, you know, I don't think if you're 90 and you get diagnosed with prostate cancer, you should get treated. I mean, let's have some common sense with some doctors here, you know, not everybody, but we do have some doctors who want to, like, be in someone in your 90s wanting to treat them, like, really. So,
right.
I just really think there needs to be some more common sense. But I think in 10 years that I've been doing this, there's been such an improvement in treatment options.
Yes.
Outcomes and that we need to really be focusing on that. It's not the horror story that everyone seems to make it out. Yeah, there are side effects, but there are side effects with every treatment, and there's over-treatment in every area, even breast cancer. You know, so you don't really hear about that.
Right.
Did you hear about it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
I'm always railing against NIH, but like every single prolife with the NIH has been like totally like Sean. I know, like, you know, that DOD money has been slashed as well. So I mean, it's actually discouraging. I said it before. It's actually discouraging, like, for people like me that to write grants because you spend so much time doing it, and you know there's like a snowball's chance in hell of getting it. You know, because the review committee, they see what prostate is bad on the title. I mean, it's all going to put down like tertiary kind of review process. So it's actually kind of discouraging. It's actually detrimental because I mean, how many more can we actually put time together and write it and waste like 4 months of our time?
Right. And I think that's a key point. That's, you know, one of the issues I know you brought forward in the national policy agenda as well is, you know, how do we get better or work within the system better to make sure that they're looking at grants like that and being willing to fund things of that nature. So I'm wondering for all of you that are here in the room, is there ways that you see the Men's Health Caucus being a successful advocate to better do that? Is it about getting individuals on committees and these task forces and these, you know, grant review committees that we need to be doing better? You know, what is it that we can do to make an impact?
It's like actually, like, really a quest to help advocates to review your stuff.
Right.
You pinpoint these people and say, I want this person to review it. And you can do that. Just finding these people and having them agree, like, you know, I'm willing to do this.
Right.
That's something, perhaps, that's just not talking about right now.
Yeah. There's another thought over here, too, yeah.
Talking about the IPAP and PCORI. PCORI is all about having, and I know we're trying to get funding, it's all about having the patient direct the research. And
yep.
For them to be excluded from this board in making these decisions, it makes no sense to me whatsoever. I mean, I have a lot of issues with the Affordable Health Care Act. And I mean, I'm all for people having health care, but health care access, insurance is not equal access. And you know, I'm really interested to see how this is going to play out in a few years. But, you know, I really think that the caucus is a great thing, and I think that we need to make sure that we do have stakeholders, we do have people with them, we do have that voice in there, because they listen, I got screened, and I'm here. And it's not all about prostate cancer. It's about high blood pressure. It's about everything.
Yeah.
Men and even and boys. So I think there's so much that we can be focusing on this night, and I think you have a really big role.
Appreciate the feedback. You know, one of my thoughts too is, you know, we were Jim and I were just over in Vienna, Austria, for the Men's Health World Congress, where they debuted the EU State of Men's Health Report. And Jim, I'd love to hear what you think about this. Is that, you know, I'm wondering how we can leverage a document like this, right? So if this covers every EU member country and it profiles the health of men, boys, and their families across the EU, how can we leverage a document like that to make an impact here in the States? So if our members of Congress may not respond to the advocacy that we're putting forward, how can we leverage documents that are global like that, that are taking a look at U.S. versus EU, and, you know, for better or for worse, they seem to respond to competition up there on the Hill. So, darn, we're not doing as well as our friends in the EU, because we're not. So if you look at the profile in this document, we're lagging behind. So I don't know, Jim, do you think there's a unique opportunity for us to leverage an EU State of Men's Health Report over here?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a voice. It gives an international voice, not that we're trying to compete with the EU, but they're doing something. You know, they're doing something, and for us to sit back and say we're not doing anything related to this at a national level, I think it's embarrassing, it's a shame, it goes against democratic principles of what our country is based on. Another area to even consider is to move away from the prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. Having discussions and partnering with some people across the way at IHES and looking at preventative mechanisms that we have, because unintentional injuries are somewhere like third on the leading list of mortality and morbidity statistics, particularly in young men. So those data from the EU are tremendously impactful in the EU, and they're transformative in terms of what can be provided in terms of funding with their mechanisms, but also what we're doing with NIH and any other funding. I think the leverage component is 100% dead on. They just have to figure out the mechanism to do so.
Right. And I know, just building off of his point there, is one of the key takeaways for me from that meeting was we had talked about having the Congressional Men's Health Caucus in the U.S. Congress actually go over and do a cross-ocean meeting with our friends, and there's a men's health body within the European Parliament. So have a U.S. Congress caucus go sit down with the EU Parliament men's health group and talk about ways that the two groups could share best practices, talk about ways to tackle issues in their respective areas, and give further light to both our national policy agenda as well as their EU State of Men's Health report. So there was talk of having that event in London over the next 6 months. So if that's something that you guys would be interested in learning more about or sharing some information that could be taken over for a meeting like that, I think the hope is that the more that resources, people, and information that we can get involved both internationally and nationally here, the better. Because it seems like they're perking up and paying attention when they hear some of this global stuff. Because I have to say, when I brought that opportunity to Runyon, Schuller, you know, Crapo, Stabenow, a lot of the other supporters in Congress, they were, you know, chomping at the bit to want to go and participate in a meeting like that. So, you know, more unique opportunities, I guess, is maybe the way to say it, to get them both out there in the community to partner with us on these things, but at the same time raising their profile to get them to work with some of their international colleagues to make a difference. Have you guys, I guess one of the other opportunities is recognizing that the March on Washington is one way to do it, to show that we're angry about this issue. Is there ways and things that you all are doing in your local areas that we can tie an advocacy piece into? Because for better or for worse, the way to truly make an impact in policy and advocacy is to be in those district offices in a lot of our representatives' home states and home districts. Is there some things that you guys have coming up, maybe say over the next month, next 3 months, next 6 months, that could be one of those collaborative opportunities that we're talking about? You guys have some things cooking, you know, screenings, awareness events, campaigns. Maybe you're doing something for Movember. Maybe you're planning for next year's June Men's Health Month. You know, is there something like that cooking that you might be an opportunity for us? Yeah, Mike, what's... Oh, Steve, go ahead.
No, we're just, like, I'm partnering up with the local cancer care center down there. There's one urologist that was advocating for PSA. We're kind of partnering with them. We're applying funds from Livestrong to kind of take it from, like, one cancer center to, like, the whole metropolitan in Orlando to go around and do this informed decision making based. Here's what's the information for PSA. Just like one of those community based, like, grassroots kind of information projects. So that's something we're doing. Also, the letter writing campaign, our local
That's great. And if it's helpful to you guys, there's press releases that have been cooked up by the Prostate Cancer Roundtable. There's joint statements and advocacy letters that have been put together. So our hope is that if we can make it as turnkey as possible, if you want to raise your voice on this, that we can give you some cooked up material for it. Steve, were you going to throw something out there?
Yeah. We're doing November with our local hockey team, and that'd be a great opportunity for us to do that. So we're doing that for 30 days in November. And then we'll have our African American Mid-Self and then our regular Mid-Self. That'll be June and September. So those will be great opportunities to really get the sun. Coming from the health care system in Oklahoma, the act is I've come from the side of community benefits since we're a nonprofit. Well, like you say, they're looking at cutting, even though they think people have access. They don't have the education, the support, especially people that have never had it. So that's what Rural is trying to do in the Men's Health, is to educate those folks and get them into those areas where they need to go and give them all those resources and forms that they can get to. So that's one thing that we're seeing in Oklahoma, is just keeping that education, prevention, and all that stuff, and bringing in the female, the women's groups, which has been very successful for us.
Yes. That's great. That's great. Some other thoughts around the national policy agenda. For the places of work for you guys, whether you're in academic institutions or community-based organizations, is there an opportunity for, are they adopting policy agendas where you all work? Is this something that they're willing to sign on and support things like this? Are you as individuals able to lend your name to things like this? Kind of just curious, you know, what the state of the institutions are that you all are working in. Do they get behind things like this? Anybody? You guys? I saw a head no over here, so maybe.
I'm an undergraduate at Indiana University.
Okay.
And, in the Wilson area, there are very few resources for mental health, but we use the Children's Health Department at the university. And I live in a very rural area, and so in terms of access and cost, I'm then in the area where I've been providing the youth preventive care services that you can describe.
Yeah.
So, and even if they had a lot of times
they just don't know better. And they don't have
email. I mean, with just a very rural community, it's a challenge to be able to.
Right.
Yeah,
please.
Well, I'm from Columbia University, and so we work with Columbia and New York Presbyterian Hospital. Mm. And I'm proud of this. We do have a young men's clinic that offers free care for men regardless of their health insurance or not. And it's really unique in New York City. Only clinic in New York for young men specifically. And so they do, you know, a lot of STD testing and treatment. And another component of what they do is offer mental health for men. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering where that fits into the mental health pocket. I came a little late, but I didn't share all of the agenda items that I do focus on doing now, prostate cancer screening, and that's very important. But for our clinic, we have learned that men need mental
Yes, absolutely.
And
if you didn't hear mental health coming through loud and clear today, it's my own bias because I'm pissed off about the task force decision. So I'm a little caught up in the prostate cancer battle that we're caught in here in the at the moment. But you're exactly right. For depression, anxiety, stress, and other mental health issues, they're huge issues. And that's definitely a key pillar within the caucus. There you go. He's got a few dollars to play with, right?
And his girlfriend is actually the one who's pioneering this for our clinic because she is a doctor.
That's great information. Because I'm just thinking, you know, just as you mentioned, with the men's health clinic and others, thinking that, you know, there's a Baltimore Men's Health Center. I know, Albert, you're doing some awesome stuff up in Cambridge and in Boston. I'm just thinking, is the natural next step for the national policy agenda to get organizations that are committed to providing services to men to kind of sign on and support this? So it's not just us like-minded individuals always talking to each other. You know, maybe like Steve's Integris Health can jump on board, the clinics and centers can jump on board. Do you think that would be a chance? Or?
I do, and I think that having these clinics that are focused just on men, it just creates an inviting health environment for men to go to receive the care that they need rather than a family or just, you know,
right.
Women, just for that.
Great. That's a great point. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Similar to what you're, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but nice to meet you. The issue also is we're thinking of men as if they're one homogenous group.
Right.
And the issues are disparate groups. In particular, obviously men as a whole, if compared to the female population, are somewhat underserved. But there's the other groups that I'm sure that New York Presbyterian serves. Up in Boston, here we have the Whittier Health Clinic, which is also mm-hmm. Men's Health Advocacy Network, the Cambridge Health Alliance, and a host of others. So I'm not saying that we should kind of just dissipate that broad perspective, but we certainly have to speak and give voices to men that are not remotely heard, let alone
yep.
men in general. So I commend those efforts.
And on that note, so we are in a predominantly Dominican but we do think we have patients coming from Newark, New Jersey, young men coming in for our screening and counseling services because they don't have insurance, or they just don't feel comfortable going somewhere out of their community.
Right.
Yeah. And oftentimes, no access or not accessing, we interpret as being don't care. So young men, they don't care about that. Not on their agenda, when in fact it very well could be. It's all with how it's framed. So
yep.
Again, I commend those efforts.
Yeah, that's great. Well, good. That's really good. And, one of the other pieces I was just thinking through as you brought that up was, so creating infrastructure within some of these respective institutions and clinics and centers. Thinking, I just received an email this past week from a medical student at the University of Michigan who is a part of the American Student Medical Association, who wanted to create a men's health caucus within the Medical Student Association, and was just chatting with a student male nurse who wanted to do the same thing in the Nurses Association. So I'm wondering, as we continue partnerships with groups like yourselves and collaborating in the different work of these centers and clinics, can we also continue kind of this movement of creating infrastructure that, as we're trying to reach out to young men and underserved and poor men and all men across the country, can we use some of these existing associations that maybe we're also a part of, not just APHA, to raise our voices within those too? Are there some other associations that you guys are a part of in this room that you think might be a natural for us to kind of continue or might be interested recipients of the national policy agenda? Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you're already working with them, but there's the National Association of State Prostate Cancer Coalition.
Yes.
The California Prostate Cancer Coalition. I know the president of both of them, but I'm sure they're involved with you guys already, but if not, I'm happy to get them to get with you guys.
Okay, great. Thank you. Justin, yeah.
The agenda specifically talks about mindset with regards to research.
Yes.
And I know that recently the Huntington Cancer Institute in Utah, which is one of the major research groups that's being funded by the national government mm-hmm. to do research, has picked up studies for prostate cancer specifically, and looking into prostate cancer screening. So hopefully organizations that have the leeway and the funding to do that type of research can continue to do so in a way that can change, perhaps, what the perspective is on prostate cancer.
Yes.
And so I think if we can leverage the agenda with perhaps organizations or research institutes that are, I guess, sensitive to the issue or willing to listen,
mm-hmm.
We can push the agenda there, have them adopt it, and
right.
then the research can go in that direction. Make it have kind of a focus, just like we do as a caucus now.
Right. And do you have a comment? Yeah.
I was going to say, I'm a general internist here in D.C., and I actually trained at the Young Men's Clinic at Columbia.
There you go.
So one of the things that I felt here as a general internist is that there's a big focus on there's no home, no medical home for men in general. So I mean, internists should be playing that role, but we don't have a GYN equivalent for women. So urologists are a tough sell because there's definitely a conflict of interest, and obviously they want to preserve the PSA. Part of their, I mean, that really is just transparent. You have the urologists on board. Now, getting more of the internists and joining forces with some of the
it's an excellent point. And I know that the urologists are very vocal about, you know, wanting to be the men's health docs. But to your point, you know, family practitioners, internists, and general practitioners are the right folks to go to, because we're trying to do a holistic approach to men's health, not just things below the belt. So there is more to guys than just stuff below the belt. Yeah. Yes, please.
Are you looking at, like, funding agencies like the DOD? Mm-hmm. We were approached just because my boss spoke at the DOD Prostate Cancer Conference last year.
Yeah.
And I know there is a move by some of the people within the DOD to move it away from, like, all the very clinical focus on prostate cancer and start looking at quality of life.
Yep.
Quality of life. And I'm just wondering if that's part of this agenda that you put together, is to, like, maybe start, you know, advocating with these funding agencies to, you know, take a different look at how they're approaching where they're spending their dollars.
Justin, you want to speak to that?
I don't think I'm necessarily
Okay. Yeah. So it's not specifically called out on the agenda as such, as you mentioned, but I think that's critically important, because with DOD, we're fighting to save our lives with the current dollars that exist, and any shift or any kind of crack in the dam, and we're gonna be in a rough spot. So yeah, well, good deal. Thank you guys so much for your participation and feedback today. We'd love to continue the conversation with you. Thanks.